This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I'm LaToya Johnson, host for the New Books Network, and it is a pleasure to be here with Dr. Bettina Judd, writer, scholar, and performer, to discuss her book, Feelin', Creative Practice, Pleasure, and Feminist and Black Feminist Thought. Dr. Judd is an associate professor of gender, women, and sexuality studies at the University of Washington, and her research centers on Black women's creativity and our use of visual art, literature, and music to develop feminist thought. Welcome, Professor Judd, and thank you for being here with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So before we focus on Feelin', can you tell us a bit about you and what led to Feelin's concept?
Right. So I firstly think of myself as an artist or as someone who creates and produces knowledge primarily through artistic practice, whether it be through poetry, performance, or like visual art. And so in thinking about kind of my place as it relates to the academy and to theory, I really wanted to produce something that not only reflected that, but also gave like a theoretically grounded reason for creative practice as theory making work. And so that was the kind of impetus of this project, was to kind of defend like my place that in this kind of in-between world of academic parlance, and then also create the creative worlds that I inhabit, and then also to give myself permission in the process to learn about my own creative process as well.
You reference Arthur Claude Brown's description of feeling as soul language. Why is it important to format the term accurately, meaning not using the apostrophe?
Right. Yeah. No. That apostrophe, right, as we know, is this way of marking a kind of incompletion or truncation, right? Whereas, like, I'd like us to think about the uses of Black language in describing this theoretical concept as already whole, as completely thought out, and as non-derivative of something else, right? Like, although we are using this kind of this language that is definitely based in the colonial imperialistic relationship with the English language, how we come to the language and how we shape our own language is complete, right? And so marking that by not using the apostrophe to kind of signal that, oh, there should be a G here is really what my kind of intention was in doing that.
Phelan references creatives such as Lucille Clifton, Avery Sunshine, Aretha Franklin, Deanna Lawson, and Joyce J. Scott. How did you decide what artists and creatives you would analyze?
In some ways, it was my encounter with work and what that encounter kind of signaled to me that revealed the various affective registers, feelings that I kind of explore. So, for instance, Joyce Scott came up, you know, I am originally from Baltimore. I was raised in Southern California, but I'm from Baltimore. And, you know, Joyce Scott is a Baltimore legend. And when I, you know, was thinking of like what Black women artists really engage with the kind of visual field of Black motherhood, like this, and the ways that that field is so mired with a racialized shaming of Black motherhood, Joyce Scott's No Mommy Me kind of made complete sense. And it was I was introduced to it by historian Elsa Barkley Brown, actually. And so it encapsulated a narrative of relating to the mammy image in Black visual art that was from the perspective of a Black child, right? Who is totally absent from that kind of public visual world, and or whose absence makes up the possibility of that public visual world. And this image is a beautiful kind of leather and bead sculpture, gives us the framework for what it means to desire mothering and what this kind of masked figure means in a real world concept, not in a fantasy world where Black folks are puppets or kind of avatars or something, but a real mother, right? And so it was a perspective I had not seen before in the visual kind of world. I'd, of course, examining all of these ways that Black women artists reclaim motherhood or reshape motherhood in a kind of visual way, but thinking of that reclamation from the position of a child who is also, you know, like who you know, is seeking not this figure of the mammy, but the person underneath that is a real maternal figure. That was something I'd never seen before. And that emotional relationship to that idea of that child really, sparked fireworks in my brain about kind of what the capacities for Black women artists are to actually disrupt, engage, and reconstitute entirely this visual field of Black motherhood. So that's one example, but, you know, like some of them, like it started with like looking at that work and then kind of coming to, you know, the kind of magnitude of what the artist has to offer for the discussion of the particular affective register, right? So like, but then also as I'm like through the various drafts of the book, a very obvious artist will like loom in the background. And like, I'm like, no, that's too obvious. Like one example, like I did want to talk about the sacred and the secular and vocal practice, right? And thinking about it through the experience of ecstasy that vocal practice kind of one practices, that rehearses, and then also invites others into the obvious choice always was Aretha Franklin, right? But I wanted to, one, like, introduce an artist who, well, at the start of writing this book was a lot more independent. Like, she's still an independent artist and a lot lesser known, but now she's had multiple albums since the beginning. And, you know, maybe some folks don't know her, but, you know, Avery Sunshine was like the primary person who I was working with. And I loved thinking with her because, like Aretha Franklin, she had ties to the church. And at the time that I had interviewed her, she was still actively working as a choir director. And, you know, I'd seen her live at a backyard kind of Black Gay Pride event in DC, you know, so, and, you know, so in these kind of secular settings, she, you know, she's singing the same songs, you know, she turned that backyard barbecue into church, separated us into altos and soprano, you know, like, and you know, we sang Safe in His Arms together, right? So, like, how does one create, you know, those kinds of space? Because it's the same practice, right? But then after multiple revisions of this chapter, it just became obvious that I needed to put the Queen of Soul, you know, in there to kind of lay out the blueprint. Because there were absolutely references, vocal references, that Avery Sunshine was giving that were direct to Aretha Franklin, and so I needed to give like the kind of reference, like I needed to do my citational practice correctly, right, and actually unpack like these two really incredible performances. It's actually, you know, at one concert, or technically at three concerts recorded over 3 days, that her Live at the Fillmore album, where she sings Spirit in the Dark and Dr. Feelgood. And, you know, like, you get that Spirit in the Dark is some kind of spiritual, like, church reference. And so you get that, like, that kind of, the way that she is invoking the aspect of ecstatic performance and experience that the church offers, right? And that, you know, the particularly like the Black church, both in kind of like Pentecostal and Baptist spaces, offers. But in Dr. Feelgood, right? In Dr. Feelgood, that is completely a song about a sexual relationship, right? And it ends in a show enough praise break, you know, shouting and all. And she herself, in one of the evenings, starts to actually like preach a little. And I'm like, how did we get here? It's because it's a practice along the same line. So, like, you know, like, there's one space where it's, where it was like clear, like, oh, I want to think about this artist and what she's doing with the sacred and the secular. And then it kind of, I had to go, you know, to the blueprint too, right? So it's another example.
I love that you mentioned that, because my next question, now, I do want to say that I understand that Feelin' was not necessarily a memoir. It was it's a scholarly work that has some of your personal life embedded into it. But you wrote intricately about spiritual and physical ecstasy in Black women's vocal styling. And so I'm glad that we started with the incomparable Aretha Franklin, because you mention a story about First Lady H, who was the minister of music at your childhood church.
Oh my goodness, yes.
And First Lady H taught you how to growl while singing. And I felt that that was a very important note to make, that this Black woman was teaching this little Black girl how to use her voice and how important that is in our community. Can we talk about that for a moment? Like, did you know what you were doing? Did you know what First Lady H was trying to attempt to do?
I thought of her as definitely trying to make me a better singer. And I absolutely, and seeing something in me that I wanted and I was reaching for, but I didn't quite have the confidence to embody, right? Like both my mother and I were known for being very kind of what they were called sweet spirits, you know, like just quiet, you know? And of course, like I'm a kid, so I don't like, you know, I also am acknowledging like, oh, they're older. Like this particular church didn't have a separated youth choir versus an adult choir. So everyone was together. And so this was something that older women, this was the work of doing of that full throated voice was the work of older women. But I just so admired, and I still do admired this first lady who was also the minister of music. And so the way that she, you know, we did this song, you know, Long As I Got King Jesus, right? And of course, starts off, I've been lied on, right? And, you know, cheated, talked about, mistreated, you know, it goes, you know, it's all of these things. And I'm like, how old am I? Like 15? Like, are all these things, you know, happening to me? Like, I'm not accessing that. And so she told me to access that. And it was, of course, a childhood thing that I accessed. It was a little girl that had lied on me in the third grade, and I had never told anybody about this. And so and she told me to tell the story too, like in choir rehearsal, right? And so everybody else is, you know, really, you know, like they're all getting, you know, upset for me. And so like it was playful, but it came, like, she wanted it to come from a real soul stirring place, even if I was downplaying it because I understood myself to be a child and for it to be a childish thing, right? She's like, absolutely, this is real. Make it real and make it plain in this space. This is a space where you can let it out. You ain't never told nobody this thing that happened. So tell us right now, right? And also the technique itself becomes tied to what the body has to do in order to do that, which is to breathe. Like, from what place are you going to tell this story? And so I actually found myself, when I was speaking it and she wanted me to speak this story, being in the same kind of vocal and breath space as a growl. She lied on me, right? That starts it off, right? You know, and so, yeah, I mean, like, just remembering this, and she's incredible. That definitely was wonderful because it was kind of it was a technical lesson, but it was also kind of an affective lesson, right? Like, it was, she knew, like, what the capacities of my voice were as the minister of music, as an incredible musician, and like what she knew that I needed, the affective work as well as the kind of technical work to make this particular sound. And so I'm incredibly grateful to them. I'm so grateful to her for that. Because, you know, singing had always, I'd always understood singing to be like a very personal practice that through which, like, I could process emotion. And I learned that from my mother, right? But my mother has a completely different vocal style than me. And so to, like, access it in this other way was, yeah, it was really great. And it helped me to understand, like, you know, what I've come to have a kind of obsession with in producing this book is kind of what are the ways that the kind of the somatic ways that Black women's creative practice is also kind of a process of a way of, one, producing knowledge, like, and also accessing the knowledge, like, and starting off by accessing the knowledge that's, like, locked in our bodies already. Right. Like, did I realize I was that angry about it? Like, you know, did, like, and to what extent, and what else did it mean, you know, for me, like, in my whole little, like, teenager world, you know, that I carried this, like, third grade thing off wind, you know, and that it was the first thing that I came to. Like, I probably had some other little incidents happen in between, but it was that one, you know. So, like, you know, that kind of knowledge, like, seedling possibility that comes through the kind of somatic experience of breath of the technical work of the growl, which I talk about it being putting God in the body, right? Of the kind of the precarious technical work of the growl, because it is a technique that could also damage your voice, right? But knowing the technique itself, you know how to protect it, right? All of that is such world building work. That allows for a lifelong practice of ecstasy, of intentionally engaging ecstasy, of inviting others into it, right? Because what that practice meant for me in practice was one thing. It also continued on to Sunday, but Sunday meant I brought the congregation into my world of feeling. Right. And wow, is that powerful for a young girl to see like her voice can, you know, like invite others into their feelings of, you know, mistreatment, neglect. But as long as I got King Jesus, you get another set of feelings. And I think that was like the first time that I had experienced my voice being able to kind of do that on that register, right? I was the sermonic solo girl, you know, the Amazing Grace right before the preacher got, you know, like, but now I was like, I was on the praise team, and that meant a whole different kind of level of spiritual sophistication too.
And so reading that line, though, my first reaction was, I wonder if that story, if that experience was foundational to feeling as a whole and in your concept and this work. Was that a start? Was that the start? Yeah.
I don't know if it was the start, right? I had an earlier memory that I do talk about at the beginning of that chapter that had to do with me sitting in the car, and I'm actually in a baby car seat with my mother. And, you know, she's practicing. My mother is and was that soprano that sung with a kind of classical training, right? And so, you know, she, of course, this is why I became like, you know, Little Nita. Her name is Juanita. I'm Little Nita. Like in terms of being the kind of sermonic soloist, right? And so she would be practicing songs in the car, and you know, I of course am very young, and I don't know the depth of what my mother might have been going through, right? She, at the time that I was really young, was a single mom, and she would come home from work and play the piano and sing. She would be in the car, and the car was just sound, and so I just wanted to join with her once, and it was a time like, you know, I don't know if I was on pitch, but I think that it would made sense that I would probably was for the first time in this moment, because I got that total body reverberation that happens when two people are singing and it's right, and the way that that made me feel, like it made me tear up as a little person, and it's still like the memory of it makes me tear up as an adult person. And so there was something about that moment that was both the sharing of sound and also space and feeling that really that was really foundational. I think that's my first memory in the car and experiencing that kind of special kind of full body sound that happens when you're singing with someone who and you are kind of on the same pitch and the same key and it made like little me tear up, right? And so I think that is like, that's the kind of core first memory, because I didn't I wanted to understand what that was unlocking. And I also wanted it to happen all the time. Right? Like, I was just like, I kind of love this thing. I love that I'm like both hearing and making sound and like tasting it. It was like a complete, like, the fact that it still happens, right, is it's a complete kind of full body experience of sound, right? It was transformative. And in the book I talk, you know, I use Bernice Johnson Reagan's way of describing the way that it's like the song is a kind, it's just a vehicle to get you to singing, and that singing is the thing that will has the capacity to transform the body, right? And so I've been chasing that. I just chased that experience. And, you know, as I, you know, started to kind of think academically, it's like, well, what is, you know, kind of what is the meaning of that? Like, not necessarily what is that in a technical way. I'm sure I could have done that in like sound studies or like psychoanalysis or some other, some kind of STEM field that has to do with like what's happening in the brain. But I wanted to know the why of it, right? Like why was it important to me? Why is it important to my mother? Like what is behind this consistent practice that we both engaged in that I learned from her?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And speaking of the Black church and the congregation and that particular community, Phelan incorporates analysis of Black queerness in those spiritual spaces. Why was it important to include that narrative?
I wanted to, because I was talking about the capacity for vocal practice to both perform, engage, and teach a kind of ecstatic practice, I had to acknowledge the ways that the setting, the environment itself, could also and does also facilitate an antithetical relationship to that practice, right? That the kind of fully embodied aspect of the sacred song that taps into the sacral space, like the sexually charged, the erotic space, that there's also this dogmatic force within many churches that teaches us that we're supposed to hate that we're supposed to suppress that, right? And I do not see it as separate from the world that would denigrate a gospel singer that became secular, right? The aspect of the church that would practice a kind of virulent homophobia is the same one that doesn't want any kind of like sexual freedom to be, or anything remotely pointing to a sexual freedom to be happening. And so I also wanted to make it clear that this is a neutral power, right? and neutral in the sense that it can always be used for extremes, right? And that there is a way that, like, yes, when Aretha Franklin is giving, it winds up in a praise break for Dr. Feelgood, right? You know, and we can see how that's like this spiritual, sacred, secular, and it's a beautiful thing. It's also a vulnerable place to be in, to be with her in that musical space. Like, that's also a part of that kind of core memory moment. It's like, it's such a vulnerable space to be unlocked sonically and in this kind of space of ecstasy that anything can come in. You are allowing anything to come in and anything can come out of you. And that particular moment also can be used to denigrate, right? It can be used to denigrate queer folks. It can be used to denigrate trans folks, to import a particular kind of shame around the very experience that they're having in that moment, right? And saying, this is the only space that you can have that feeling. If you're having it anywhere else, or if you're having it in these other contexts, you know, like, you're wrong, that there's something at the core that's wrong with you. And so, like, I wanted to make it clear that me being excited, right? Like, and I admit my affect completely changes when I talk about, you know, what it means to sing and be completely uplifted, even in this kind of ecstatic experience. I also understand, feel, and know what it means to also be injected with the denigration that happens, that does happen, using the same vocal practice. Right. And so I wanted to make it clear that I'm not a PR machine for a false narrative about some kind of sexual freedom that's happening in Black churches. It's not at all what's happening. I'm saying, like, this is how the opposite happens. Like, this is a function of, you know, like, or this can be functionalized. This can be used to do the kind of opposite work.
When writing about your interaction with poet Lucille Clifton's work, Joy, you write, "Joy comes with a load of responsibility to my community, to my family, to my God." Can you talk about that for a moment and what you were thinking when you wrote that?
I was thinking, because I was really upset. That so in the book is this, like, I'm talking about Lucille Clifton's A Theology of Joy! And it comes from this, her signature. Like, if you ever got a book signed by her in your life, or if you ever happen upon a signed book in a used bookstore, it's gonna have the same inscription. It's gonna be Joy! Lucille Clifton, right? And wanting her to sign something else, you know, was about me wanting to be connected to her. And, like, you know, as a poet, as a young poet who is really, who really admired her work, really, like, saw myself in her work, who since has, like, absolutely, like, she's kind of like a constant reference for me. In my own poetic practice, I wanted to have a connection, I wanted her to, like, sympathize with me, like, in my little sob story that I was like, yeah, you know, I had this terrible experience, and, you know, your poems about homage to my hips, and the poem, last poem to my uterus, you know, like, all of these, you know, these ways I wanted to kind of, like, trauma bond with this elder, like, you know, her pause was, you know, but always joy, right? And I was offended. Like, you know, I was hurt. I felt rejected. I felt rejected in her, like, wanting me to just, like, you know, like, get out of my pity party way of trying to connect with her. But I have since kind of, like, thought of it as, like, oh, the connection is the practice of joy that she was also invested in, like, you know, and, you know, she talks about kind of, she doesn't talk about her life as being some kind of like beautiful, joyous thing, or that she herself is in a constant state of joy. She often talked about kind of wrestling with sadness, kind of wrestling with what like we might even call depression, or, you know, like with dark stories and traumas and, but this reverberation of joy, I think she was also offering me as a teacher of poetry, right? Like quite literally, your poetry isn't going to be of interest if it's on the note, if it's not at all seeking this greater thing called joy, exclamation point. And so, that like, you know, I wrote it initially as a reflection at a memorial for her at the Enoch Pratt Library in Baltimore. And it was interesting that so many of us had a kind of story about the joy exclamation point signature. And so it was initially written, that little passage was initially written as a kind of, you know, mourning space for her just a few months after she had passed away. But it, you know, was also a reflection of a kind of great lesson in poetry writing and in living that she was offering all of us in a signature.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to transition just a little bit to a topic that it's near and dear to me. I love this topic because you write, anger tells us that there is more to know, and its ability to do so because it is an aspect of human experience for which Black women are uniquely silenced. Why was it important to discuss Black women's anger and channeling it creatively? I know, listen, talking about anger gets me excited. I can't even speak. I love it. I love talking about Black women and anger.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is it wasn't on my, like, again, is another one of those moments with the book that I wasn't invested in thinking about anger. But then I realized, like, how can I write a book about Black women's creative practice that is also about emotionality that doesn't talk about this thing, like this specter, like this big, ugly thing that's like lobbed on to Black women's emotional experience, right? And I think I was definitely avoiding it because I was like, well, we're more than our anger, you know, but I needed to step back and like actually think about the ways that, you know, what I'm really arguing in the book for is a kind of what I call a sedulous and a deep engagement with Black women's creative work that focuses on the emotional, that focuses on feeling, right? And so anger, it was important to engage with because it is something that is so totalizing about in terms of the image or the outside framework of Black women's experience, that anger could be the reason given for any of the other affective registers that I talk about in the book. Like ecstasy could be mistaken, you know, for anger, you know, like, you know, in shame could be mistaken for any of the, and, you know, I'm writing this also in, before and then also during and in the wake of Sandra Bland's death and how anger was completely like circulating around some kind of reason for why she should die or could die or was destined to die there. I was like, oh, this is dire. Like, this is incredibly, this is, I have to talk about anger. And I also had to talk about Sandra Bland in this kind of this discussion of anger to communicate the stakes of how deeply invested the world we live in is in denigrating and silencing Black women's knowledge by projecting anger, right? So, you know, when it came to the story of Sandra Bland, like I'd actually written the chapter in full before the Sandra Bland incident happened at all. But when it did, and, you know, I got past, like, I never wanted to see that video. I ended up watching it to kind of get a sense of the exchange and to note how everything that she said, yes, she could have been angry, should have been angry, but everything she said was a description of what Officer Insignia, of what Brian Insignia was doing, right? She was a complete, like, she was completely documenting the experience. She was bringing forth knowledge, but the cloud, like, everything that he's responding to is a projection of her presumed anger, like her irrationality, but it is his hatred that's fueling that. Right. And then it becomes the story of, like, of her, of this particular encounter. There's, you know, pundits talking about her being belligerent or her being arrogant, her being angry. And really, like, I was blown by this, because when you do look at the, and you hear and you read the transcript of the encounter, she is describing what is happening. She is, like, literally, it's like a data download of what is happening, and that rhetorical move to decide that this is a, like, what she is saying is irrational anger, it's arrogance, it's, is a way to silence that information. It was just the fact that she was just giving information, right? And so that, to me, was like a dire, hurtful, depressing example of the stakes of what it means to actually engage with Black women's speech as knowledge producing, right? Like, this isn't, Sandra Bland isn't an artist in this moment, right? She is merely speaking, but to engage deeply, not to kind of refute that she is angry and say, like, no, we're not angry as Black women, to actually, fine, she's angry. What about it? Let's get into it. You know, like, what is happening here to produce that anger, to actually take it seriously, I think is, you know, the key and important kind of methodological work that we can be doing with anger.
And I did love that, that kind of, like, ends the book in a way, because it's like, can we focus on this formula moment that Black women do have reasons to be angry. We're just not angry. We didn't grow out of the ground with this emotion. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is. Be like irrational or unimportant, you know.
And that it comes from somewhere. And can we start asking where it's coming from?
Where it's coming from, exactly. And getting into the contours of what it means to be a Black woman who knows all of those things, like, knows the way that anger is projected and is so very much also actively controlling the pathways by which they are communicating in order to kind of quell that. Because Sandra Bland could have been a whole lot, like, visibly angry, you know, like, much more visibly angry, like. And I think we all, and of course, I'm citing these studies where, in that chapter, where it, you know, researchers, or these researchers are finding that Black women actually, as, like, particularly in professional settings, often quell their anger and like often kind of repress their anger, and that is a practice that what is also detrimental to our health. But then it also becomes an art form, you know, in terms of our ways of expressing knowledge, right?
Dr. Jed, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for talking
for talking about Feelin. Feelin is in bookstores now. So go on out. It's really good. It's really good reading. Go and get it. Thank you. Sure.